Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. This is Unpacking Peanuts. This is 1955, part two. This is a great year, guys. Charles Schulz is rocking and rolling, and we're just going to start getting into the depths of some of the greatest comic strips ever drawn. I'm Jimmy Gownley. You might know me from my comic book series, Amelia Rules. Or you might know me from my memoir, The Dumbest Idea Ever. Or you might know me from my new book, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. Or you might not know me at all. Joining me, as always, are my two fabulous co-hosts and also amazing cartoonists. He's from the hit television show Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's the executive producer and writer. He was also a vice president of Archie Comics and the current creator of the Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Mr. Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
He's a playwright and composer for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast, and the cartoonist behind such great strips as Strange Attractors, Tangled River, and A Gathering of Spells, Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
So we're just going to get right into it and start delving into these comic strips in like minute, insane, worrisome detail. And if you'd like to follow along with us, why don't you go on to gocomics.com where they have the complete run of Peanuts comic strips. You could just type in the dates and follow along there. Or if you want to treat yourself, go out and buy the Fantagraphics volumes. They completely collect the entire run. They don't pay us to say that. I'm just giving you a heads up because they're beautiful books. Guys, 1955, it's a great year. Should we just jump into it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's do it. June 1st, Charlie Brown and Schroeder are standing outside. Charlie Brown is wearing a coonskin cap and has a toy gun. Schroeder also has a toy gun. Charlie Brown says, "I'll be Davy Crockett because I have this cap." Schroeder says, "Okay, but who will I be?" Charlie Brown says, "Let me think. I don't know many others." Charlie Brown and Schroeder are now stalking in the background. Patty looks at them and says, "Well, what's this, Pioneer Days?" Schroeder says, "He's Davy Crockett, and I'm Sam Sneed." But wait, there's more. June 28th. Charlie Brown and Shermie are both standing outside. They are both wearing coonskin caps. Charlie Brown says, "Everybody's wearing Davy Crockett caps." Shermie says, "Everybody?" In the foreground walks Snoopy. He is proudly wearing a coonskin cap. Charlie Brown says, "Everybody."
First of all, how come Schroeder isn't Beethoven?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. That would have been hilarious. That's, you know what, Michael, that's, I think, the second time you've improved a Peanuts gag. It's getting scary.
I guess Schulz was a big golf nut, and Sam Sneed was the Tiger Woods of his day.
So he really was.
My first pair of hand-me-down golf clubs from my dad were Sam Sneed's signature model.
Yeah, Sam Sneed was he. I think he won the most Masters up to the point when he was golfing. He was, I think, the oldest one ultimately to win the Masters. And Schulz claims he actually saw Sam Sneed perform what he called a truly flawless round at the St. Paul tournament, probably when he was a kid.
Wow.
So Sam Sneed must have been a hero to Charles Schulz.
So what's up with these dead animals on their heads?
Well, that's the thing. I believe that nowadays they're plastic, but in the good old days, maybe they were fur. I don't know.
Wait, what do you mean nowadays? You think the modern kids...
They're available. Coonskin caps.
The major difference is that their coonskin caps are synthetic.
You can buy coonskin caps on Amazon for $25.
Can you really?
Bucks.
Well, yes. How do we not have three of them for recording days?
I don't know. Our audience is probably wondering the same thing.
Now, did you have one of these?
Did I? As a kid, yes.
Amazing.
And all my friends did. I was having a Zoom call with my Bellingham friends. Mm-hmm. I hadn't told them about the podcast before, and I was telling them, describing it to them. And I said, "So we're doing 1955, and we got into this like half-hour discussion of Davy Crockett." Mm-hmm. And my friend Jeremiah walks across the room and he comes back and he's got a coonskin cap
on. That's awesome.
Wow. Boy.
Well, there were four of us and all of us had coonskin caps as kids. But the thought of wearing a dead animal on your head with its tail hanging down is pretty repulsive.
It really is when you think about it.
Especially if you're bald.
You know what? Speaking of bald, you know what's depressing? Last year I went as Charlie Brown for Halloween and no one even noticed. I just thought I was wearing a yellow shirt. So why is everybody, Harold, I bet you know why everybody's all hyped about Davy Crockett in 1955.
It's time for the Peanut Time Machine.
Yeah, so Davy Crockett actually comes from the Disneyland show on the ABC, which is premiered in October of 1954. And with a house full of kids, you know the Disneyland show was playing in the Schultz household. That's pretty much a guarantee. But what happened was, so ABC was in the ratings basement in 1954. They needed some help. They decided to go to Walt Disney and ask him if he would make a television show for them, which was pretty unheard of at the time, because back then, he was making most of his money from the theatrical world of movies and shorts and playing in theaters. And most studios, pretty much all of the studios at this point, were avoiding television, trying to push television away, not give them content as much as possible, because it was competition to them. They were scared they were going to lose their business model. And so they were not involved in television. So it was a big deal for ABC to come to Disney and say, hey, we want you to do this show for us. And Disney said yes, because he was just about to launch Disneyland in Anaheim. And he wanted a way to promote his new physical world that you could walk into that was Disney. And that was a huge idea. And there was a ton riding on it. Disney was spending most of his time trying to build this this amazing amusement park like no one had ever seen before. And he thought this would be the perfect vehicle through a major television show to get millions of people aware of this spot in Anaheim that he needed to work. And so that's what happened. The show came out. It was an instant success. And in December of 1954, they started a little mini series of Davy Crockett to represent Frontierland, which was going to be one of the lands in Disneyland. And that is what happened to create all this furor. Apparently the first episode came out and was well watched, and kids were like, oh, this is great. And they were telling all their friends. And by the time the second episode came out, it got a 50 share. Half of all televisions that were on were tuned in to Disneyland to see the second episode of Davy Crockett. And it went huge. Every child in America all of a sudden wanted to be Davy Crockett. And that's where the coonskin caps came from. They sold 5.5 million books and over 10 million copies of the song. I don't know if you guys know the song. Anyone sing?
Davy. Wait. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee. Shot himself a bar when he was on three. Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Right?
Yeah. And that, there were three versions of the song on the charts at the same time. That was how big it was.
Well, you may have thought we played a record there, but we didn't. That was me recreating it. I transported you back to 1955.
So YouTube, you don't drop us. Then like, wait a second, that's Fess Parker.
We are demonetizing
this. That is not yours. But they sold $300 million worth of Davy Crockett merchandise, which in today's dollars would be like $3 billion.
Wow.
And it all happens in the course of this year that Charles Schulz 14 times brings up the Davy Crockett phenomenon, because Charles Schulz was a pop culture guy, right? He was trying to find out how to make an impact through his newspaper strip. And he's just starting to see some success with that Kodak deal that he made. He's got an eye, I think, on what this whole system is like. I think he actually applied to work for Disney at one point.
He did, yes. So
this was something that was close to him. And he's looking at this amazing phenomenon and he's probably trying to take it apart and understand what's going on, because it's the first major television fad that the country had ever seen. And it kind of blows over almost as quickly as it started. By the end of 1955, the Davy Crockett fad is pretty much played out. And on June 29th, there is a major event that occurs during one of the Davy Crockett strips where Linus is following Lucy to a street corner. And then she says that he needs to hang on to her when he crosses the street. And so he holds not Lucy's hand, but the tail of the coonskin cap as they cross the street. So there was a bit of Peanuts history happening during the coonskin craze.
See, you can't sleep on any of these little odd corners, you know, at the golf tournament, we found out it was Lucy Van Pelt. And here we have another historic moment in one of the odd little Peanuts corners.
Well, it is really pretty historic. I mean, Linus has been a baby crawling around for all this time, and then suddenly he's walking.
It is very exciting. I'm really enjoying watching the growth of Linus, and spoiler alert for next year, but I've been reading ahead, and there's at least one Linus Charlie Brown moment that legitimately gave me the chills. It was so exciting to see. So look forward to that as we progress, people.
Yeah, and if you guys listening, point us out if we have gotten something wrong, if we miss something, we say a first is a second, let us know. Give us a ring, an email, and we will try to correct ourselves as we go forward.
Yeah, you can check us out at unpackingpeanuts.com. And of course, you can follow us on social media at unpackpeanuts on either Instagram or Twitter. And we would love to hear from you. Oh, hey, Michael, here we're looking here at July 19th next. And this is a new version of Snoopy almost, it seems like we're seeing here.
It's Snoopy Watch.
Yeah, we're seeing Schultz changing the design and trying to make Snoopy a little more expressive. So he's looking a little less like a real dog and a little bit more cartoony, has a long extended snout. Yeah, this is a visual gag. And by the way, this is the start of the horseshoe craze of 1955.
You know, it's just synthetic horseshoes today.
Yeah.
The artwork in this strip of, there are four gorgeous drawings of Snoopy here, including the third panel. If anyone is able to look up July 19th, they're just these gorgeous drawings of Snoopy. Yet the banana nose is in the first panel. The third panel is a really adorable picture of Snoopy kind of crouching down to avoid the horseshoe landing right behind him. And then the fourth one, he's all frazzled and kind of a classic Snoopy frazzled image, but they're all beautiful. The design of this thing and the structure of it it's just amazing. I'm in awe of Schultz able to make these beautiful iconic drawings just one after another.
My favorite drawing in this strip is the third panel with Snoopy ducking to avoid the horseshoe coming in.
Yeah, me too.
Great lettering, of course, throughout as well. One of my favorite things to look at. But also,
yes,
I've never really met Schultz is a lifelong dog lover. So I do think a lot of this, the really good drawings of Snoopy when Snoopy is behaving more dog-like might be observed from, you know, family pets and stuff like that.
Did he have a dog?
Right. And one thing,
he had dogs his whole life. I mean, I'm not sure at every single point of the 50 years he did the strip, but he had many dogs. Yeah.
Did he have did he have a beagle, by the way?
Well, I don't know if he had a beagle. I didn't get into all that, but he did have a dog named Snoopy that he gave away.
Ooh.
I could if you want, I could find that story.
And he did have a dog named Spike as growing up, right?
Yes, Spike is the original model for Snoopy.
As a little teenager.
Yes, and I'm not sure if we ever mentioned this in the first episode when we were talking a little bit about his life, but the first thing he ever had published nationally was a drawing of the dog Spike in a panel cartoon called Ripley's Believe It or Not, which you might know today. I think there's probably online videos. There was TV shows at various points throughout the decades where they would just tell you some
museum.
Yeah. Museums. There's still a museum in New York and stuff. Yeah. And they would tell you some sort of half baked, half true myth from the past or some sort of weird science anomaly. And then end with Believe It or Not. Well, Schultz's was just that his dog, Spike, ate razors and tacks and stuff like that.
Nowadays, it's just called Believe It.
I will say one thing about the lettering. It gives us a sense of how Charles Schultz's art is starting to loosen. he's really not spending as much time as he was, say, a year ago with those amazingly designed, incredibly crisp lines. The lettering is still really designy, but it's a little more scratchy, a little looser. It's something he's moving into, and we're going to see more and more of, I think, as the years progress.
Yeah, the looseness of the lettering in the third panel, where you see it looks like there's almost parts that haven't been colored in the letters. It's achieved by you write it once, and then you write it again, and you don't care if you match in all the places exactly. Jules Pfeiffer goes on, and like his whole lettering career looks like this period of Schultz lettering to me when he was doing the expressive sound effects. July 24th, Patty and Violet are spinning in jump rope. Snoopy is jumping the rope between them. We have four panels of him blissing himself out as he frolics in the jump rope before landing wham flat on his back. He's dazed, and then Patty and Violet turn to each other, and Violet says, "Well, what do you think? Shall we do something else for a while?" They turn to walk away, and Patty says, "We might as well. Let's go over to my house for some lemonade." Snoopy's lying on his back. "Whew," he says to himself. When will I ever learn?
And this was part of the great jump rope craze of 1955.
Interestingly, now the jump ropes are made of dead animals. So, you know, it's a pendulum.
Boy, these Snoopy drawings are just consistently gorgeous from here on out. He's really making this adorable character. You can see the hints of the superstar about to come.
Yeah. July 31st. It's baseball day. Schroeder's behind the plate. Pigpen's at bat. Charlie Brown is on the mound. Snoopy close behind him. Charlie Brown throws a classic Charlie Brown pitch into Pigpen, who clobbers it. It's a line drive over Charlie Brown's head. Snoopy leaps up and catches it in his mouth, which sends him flying backwards and tumbling around. Charlie Brown is shocked, tries to grab the ball from Snoopy, saying, "Give me that ball. He's going to score. Give me it, I say." Snoopy's growling at him. Charlie Brown picks up Snoopy and holds him over his head. Charlie Brown says, "By golly, I'm not going to fool around with you." We see Pigpen running home as Charlie Brown yells, "Home, home, get him at home." Charlie Brown throws the ball, still in Snoopy's mouth, and Snoopy to Schroeder as Pigpen dives headfirst for home. We see a cloud of dust, which then clears, and then Pigpen says, "I'm safe," as he looks at the ball on the ground, Schroeder still holding Snoopy in his glove. Charlie Brown says, "Oh, good grief." Then Charlie Brown turns to Snoopy and says, "You drive me crazy."
This is one of the best choreographed Sundays.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need any words. It's just crystal clear what's going on.
That's true.
There's so much to love here. There's so much about the characters that we've come to know that is peppered all the way through this strip. You got Charlie Brown lobbing a pitch that looks like Charlie Brown's got this determined look on his face, but he's throwing it and it's just kind of a little arcing up in the air as if it has absolutely no power to it. And then you got his little hand in the back of his glove. You can see it through the back of the glove. That it's about 1/8 the size of the actual glove with the little thumb sticking out in the bottom. It's just adorable. And then you have Pigpen in the next panel hitting it, and when he hits it, you see his batting average in a little starburst, which I think is also adorable. I don't know if that was an old sports cartoon image that they used to be cartoonists who would just do sports cartoons for the local paper or the national paper, and I'm wondering if he's taking that from that tradition.
Yeah,
I
maybe
really don't know.
Sports cartoons were huge in the days before there was ready photography for baseball games and fights and stuff that would be happening in the middle of the day. He does years later introduce a character named Jose Peterson. And I remember Jose Peterson's batting average appeared that way.
And it's a really good batting average.
Yeah,
right?
Well, actually, can I say he's a 3-something?
3-15.
Yeah, oh, are you kidding? He's heading for the Hall of Fame. 3-15. Way to go, Pigpen.
Yeah. And Snoopy's not yet a member of the team. No. So they have to fight him over getting the ball rather than him getting Pigpen out. There's an amazing drawing of Snoopy after catching the ball right behind Charlie Brown, it's too tall for Charlie Brown, but Snoopy's able to jump up. Again, the laws of physics, it's all about the visual and how it's good design. there's this bizarre motion line of Snoopy somehow tumbling toward Charlie Brown from how he's fallen. There's no description for how those motion lines could have actually happened in real life, but visually it looks amazing. And with Charlie Brown running with Snoopy over his head, kind of stiff, holding the ball in his mouth, like with a big question mark coming out of Snoopy's head. It's just an amazing strip, totally worth looking this thing up and seeing this July 31st strip. And then, of course, Pigpen makes a cloud of dust wherever he goes. That's now in the gag as something we just either we know or we don't know. He's creating his own cloud of dust. And then the little Snoopy drawing as...
Oh, in the glove?
So no? Schroeder is just looking at him inside of Schroeder's glove is absolutely adorable. This little innocent look on his face, looking into the eyes of Schroeder.
It is one of the best.
And then Charlie Brown's famous good grief. Yeah.
So many panels in this. This ranks up there with the 5 and 10 store and a couple other of those strips. The last baseball strip we discussed with Patty batting. He's just so good. And it also, you know, not to harp on this, but it does highlight to me again how off that the golfing outing seems. When you see that last panel on tier 2, which is so beautifully composed, even though it has 5 characters and 3 word balloons in it, it's just masterfully done. It's really, really great.
Who's on third?
That's a great okay, who is that? Is that somebody? Is that an unknown Peanuts?
That's Jose Peterson.
Where?
All right, let's blow it up. I'm blowing it up and see if I can figure this one out.
Oh, which actually makes me think, Harold, maybe Pigpen's batting average is terrible because if he's primarily batting against Charlie Brown.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Is that from other teams he's played against?
Let's hope.
So is that Shermy? Is that Shermy far off in the distance?
I would guess it's Shermy. It's not a girl. So, and it's not Linus. So it has to be Shermy.
Well, you know, I'm really also glad that you mentioned the motion lines, Harold, and how they don't quite make sense, because this brings me to something that I think might be a continuing feature going forward. But this is the first time I would like a do-over. I would like to just briefly rediscuss a strip from 1954.
Oh.
Because I think I missed the point, and I think there's something interesting to be found there.
Oh, what
is that? You guys up for that?
Yeah, which one?
It is the potato chip.
Oh, the one that's floating down like a leaf?
Yeah, this is very important, actually. This is cartooning masterclass, if I can just find what date that is.
Let's see.
It's a... May 26th.
May 26th, 1954. Charlie Brown and Violet are talking. Charlie Brown is holding a bag of potato chips. Violet says, "I like potato chips." Charlie Brown says, "That's good. Just hold out your hands." She does, and Charlie Brown dumps some potato chips into her hands. One starts to fall. "Whoops," Violet says, "you spilled one." Charlie Brown says, "Don't worry, it'll never hit the ground." They watch as it flutters to the ground, and then Snoopy bursts into panel, snagging it with his mouth before it even has a chance to hit the ground. Gulp. Okay, so when we were talking about this last time, Michael and I were saying that the motion lines on the potato chip, beneath the potato chip, are indicating that it is fluttering. And you, Harold, were saying, well, it can't be that it's like a magic potato chip, because then it's not a funny joke, right? Because the joke is that the millisecond you drop it, Snoopy is there to get it before it even hits the ground. So this is really like super weird, because it's this conceptual strip that you really could not do in any other medium, because you're if you look at it visually, Charlie Brown and Violet, just visually, are all taking place at one speed. Let's call that like the normal speed of just life, right? The potato chip and Snoopy in the foreground, we're actually seeing in super slow motion. They're behaving at two entirely different rates of speed. And then you add in the words, which don't match either.
you could argue that the potato chip has one speed, is slow speed, and Snoopy is ultra fast speed. So there's like three speeds.
Well, don't forget the Einsteinian equations here factor in. The potato chip's in motion. Therefore, it's time is totally different frame of reference.
That is true. You know what? It is important to get into relativity at least once a decade in Peanuts. I think this is a great example. No, but I was just listening to this while we were, I was listening to the edited version of it, and I started thinking, oh, I see what Harold's saying. It's actually way weirder than that. And I don't know why everybody gets the joke when reading it. But that behaves like nothing that you could possibly replicate in life. You can never see anything like that.
The magic of comics.
Yeah.
But that's just a standard trope for like comic book covers where people are describing, you know, the bullet heading towards.
Right. Them. Yeah. It is a,
oh my God, if I don't dodge this bullet, it'll penetrate my
only
armor.
Milliseconds left to think, must remember the lessons of my master. All right, I just had to get that off my chest. Thank you.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, and I also would like to make sure I bring up Albert Payson Terhune this year.
Yeah, let's do that again. Yeah, okay. August 28th. Charlie Brown and Schroeder are out playing croquet. Schroeder says, "Come on, Charlie Brown, hit it." Charlie Brown says, "I thought I heard hoofbeats." Violet looks off in the direction of the noise and says, "Look out, here he comes again," as Linus runs for cover. "Good grief," yells Charlie Brown, as through the little croquet wickets zooms Snoopy. Zoom, zoom, zoom. "Oh no, Snoopy," yells Charlie Brown, "not those." Snoopy runs headfirst into a pole. Wham. "Boy, what a stupid dog," says Charlie Brown as he drags him home on his wagon.
Now, you're saying that the first tier on a Sunday page is always optional?
Yeah.
Okay, in this case, it doesn't seem optional. It seems like you have to set up the game.
Well, you can see that they're playing.
Well, I mean, you could remove it, but it is a lot less effective. I'll give you that for sure. You know, maybe there's an element of Schultz who didn't want to even kowtow to that kind of editorial mandate. Maybe he was making the ability to break it as subtle as possible to discourage that type of printing.
It's amazing that the wickets are taller than Charlie Brown's waist. If anyone's seen a croquet wicket, it's amazing how huge these things are in these kids' lives. Snoopy can run through them.
It's interesting in panel two that Linus is actually running. So he's gone from crawling to walking to running in a couple of strips.
Yeah, the previous week he's actually using the wickets as hurdles. So Linus is moving up in the world very quickly as a active child. And then on September 18th, after a series of croquet strips that he did for Sundays, there is this amazing one with Snoopy zooming through the wickets again, where the kids are deciding they have to end this, and their solution is to push down the wicket into the ground. So Snoopy is going to slam into the wicket, which is pretty pretty cruel. But this is one of the first examples of Snoopy kind of outwitting the kids, where he's kind of on a plane above the kids that we see in Peanuts, where he's going at incredibly fast speed with a super long banana nose going toward the wicket. He's just inches away. And then in the second to last panel, he just hops over the wicket and all the kids sigh. And I was like, yeah, that's the classic Snoopy that ran for years and years, where he's almost this surreal little character. He's starting to get into that place where he's just overcoming whatever the kids are struggling with.
Seeing Snoopy zoom around like this, I have a little dog, Bichon Frise, or as I like to call it, a Bichon Frise.
Adorable.
His name Ginny. And they do this thing called the Bichon Blitz, and where they just go nuts and they just zoom around. As she does it less and less as she gets older. But she, when she was a puppy, she would do it so fast that her back legs would tumble over. She would just start doing tumble sets because she couldn't keep up with her own speed. Every time I see these Snoopy ones, it makes me think of that.
Oh, Ginny's adorable.
Shout out to Ginny. September 2nd, Charlie Brown is reading the newspaper to Lucy. He says, and it says they're going to send up a satellite that will revolve around the Earth. Lucy laughs. Ha 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 ha. Oh my, Charlie Brown, you ought to go on the stage. Ho ho ho. What a hit you'd be. I don't know how you think of those things. Charlie Brown drops the paper to the floor and says, my stomach hurts.
If someone just came to Peanuts and this was the first one they read, I wonder if they'd understand it.
I mean, yeah, you could deduce it. You could, through context clues, you could figure it out. But it's not a joke in the sense of a traditional, just you could write a joke. What it does is come completely out of Lucy's personality that he's set up.
Right. Yeah, because if somebody didn't know Lucy, they would think she's maybe being sarcastic.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Lucy is like allergic to learning the truth. It's not, it's strange. She unerringly is wrong.
And he uses that my stomach hurts punchline several times this year.
Oh, I just love that her response to him reading this newspaper article is, you ought to go on the stage. Can you see Charlie Brown reading a newspaper on the stage? That'd be great.
He's Mort Saul. Says here they're going to launch. Listen, finally, we're going to be able to recontextualize Peanuts for the younger people with our Buster Keaton, Milt Saul.
Milt Saul, wait a second. Alex, his brother? That's really getting obscure.
Wait, Mort Saul. Milt Saul, he's way
Mort's
better.
Mort's brother.
Mort Rich.
Yeah.
And who's our other guy?
Terhune. Oh, Albert Payson Terhune.
Albert Payson Terhune. There you go.
Wait till we get to the Willie McCovey strip, which is one of my all-time favorites.
I'm going to learn something.
Yeah, or Charlie Brown Spelling Bee, which is entirely based on new understanding. There's a baseball player named Willie Mays. October 26th. Charlie Brown is reading a book to Schroeder. Finally, the day came for the rehearsal of Beethoven's new symphony. Schroeder is listening. He's on the edge of his seat. Charlie Brown continues. One of the soloists complained about the difficulty of her part. She asked the composer if he would make a few changes. Schroeder stands up and yells, don't do it, Beethoven, sending Charlie Brown flying. I love that. I love that. I want to know, how much editorial pushback is Schultz getting at this point? And I always sort of feel that Schroeder is his outlet for that kind of thing.
Yeah. And this started the Beethoven craze.
Yeah, but nowadays all the Beethovens are synthetic.
Yeah, maybe this is in response to those letters that suggest killing characters like Charlotte Braun.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And Michael, I don't want to embarrass you right on the podcast, but it's pronounced Beethoven.
Oh, of course. I've never heard...
So that is how you read it as a little kid?
Oh, and Chopin? Sure.
I did Chopin as well, yes. Chopin,
yeah.
Oh, that's okay. I think like the second time I ever met Michael... We were talking about Jeff Jones, and I said, oh, I really like his idle strip. And it's, of course, idle, but no one's using the word idle in Gerardville. So you read these things and you never hear them out loud.
I bet you got the pronunciation from Mussorgsky right. So.
Yes.
No, I really thought for a long time, I was wondering who this Dylan guy was.
Dylan? Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I heard... Robert Dylan. Yeah, my big word when I was a little kid that I constantly misread, and I can't remember if I actually read it out loud in English class, to my great dismay. I don't remember, but the word was misled. That was my misled? That was the word that I
misled.
Oh. That guy misled me.
And I still love that. It sounds like
some
miserly person is leading you astray.
All right. There's a little Linus and Lucy in all of us, I guess.
A lot of Linus in me.
Oh, no kidding. What would be interesting is, you know, I'm not so interested in picking who my favorite character is. I would be interested for us to pick who we think the other characters are. I already have my I'm Lucy t-shirt. September 24th. Charlie Brown and Shermie are outside. Snoopy is frolicking in a field. Shermie says, "Boy, have you ever seen such a speedy dog?" Snoopy zips by, running in the opposite direction. Charlie Brown says, "He's getting in shape for the hunting season." Charlie Brown continues, "He's not going to let any ducks sneak up behind him." Now, the reason I picked this is this is very important to 1955. Do you guys know what is happening in this strip for the first time in 1955?
Shermie says
they're something. Celebrating the duck hunting fad of 1955.
Yeah, but all the ducks are synthetic these days. Yes, this is the first time Shermie has spoken since May of 1954.
Oh, Shermie.
This is crazy because he is the first person to speak in Peanuts, and he's being relegated. But I started thinking, if we're looking at every single one of these strips, 17,897, you know, we're going to go into all the different corners and the back alleys of Peanuts. Maybe we could find some things in Shermie that other people that have been missed out on. People haven't noticed because of his second banana status. And I thought we could introduce a little something I'd like to call the Shermometer. And thank you. And every year, we'll see if we can add something to Shermie's character that we learned in this year. My pick for 1955's Shermie personality trait is that he is a good listener, because he appeared in a bunch of other strips before this, always with someone else talking to him. In Peanuts, it feels like everybody really wants to say what they have to say. Shermie's like the one person who is like, okay, I'll let you talk. And that might not be, in a classic sense, an interesting character, but it would make for a pretty good friend. So that's my I'm adding good listener as the 1955 pick on the Shermometer. So what I'd like you guys, though, to do is you can think about, you can do it now if you want, or if you want to think about it, we could do it next episode. From those first 4 years, what are the personality traits from Shermie we could see on display? And see what we can get by the end of this 50-year journey.
Let's check the Shermometer, Charlie Brown.
Well, he certainly cares about his appearance because he got a haircut.
Okay, that's very good. Yeah.
And
all
no,
right.
No one else has gotten a haircut so far. Well, but I have a question, a very deep, solemn question.
Yes.
Why does the bald kid have a barber for a dad?
I don't know.
Dad was experimenting on him.
What's so, maybe that is it. What's so strange is Schultz always said, well, Charlie Brown's not bald. He just has basically a crew cut. And if you look at Shermie, or if you look at Schroeder and Charlie Brown sitting next to each other, that's supposed to be just a little lock in the front. Then he has very blonde, very tightly cut to his head hair. That does not come across at all. And he never colors it that way, to my knowledge.
No.
So
And then how do you have all that hair on the very forehead that's so curly?
It would be a bad haircut.
That's very modern.
The father takes out his frustrations on Charlie Brown, I think.
Maybe there's stuff going on that we don't know. Yeah, it is odd. That's on one.
I have a theory about Shermie.
Okay, go.
Maybe because Shermie was such a good observer and such a good listener, at one point or other, he stepped out of the strip and just sat alongside Charles Schultz as he drew.
Oh, isn't that nice?
That's scary.
That is true. Don't go in the studio. Shermie's in there. He's left the strip.
He's broken the sixth wall.
Okay, so, all right. But, okay, good listener, cares about his appearance. We got two things already.
Well, his jacket is a little wrinkled in this episode, so... He's not that natty.
All right, so everyone come back next month for the Shermometer, where we're going to have at least six solid personality things.
And when it hits 100, he disappears forever.
Maybe we'll find out that Shermie is like the 20th century Hamlet. Who knows? Could happen. November 3rd. Charlie Brown looks angry. Violet is walking by, and he says to her, "Boy, am I ever disgusted." He continues, "They won't let dogs run loose anymore. All the dogs in the city have to be kept tied up." Violet says, "Have you tied up Snoopy?" Charlie Brown says, "Of course. What else could I do?" In the last panel, we see Snoopy tied to the tree as if he has been kidnapped and tied to a railroad track, but standing upright.
That's got to be a good t-shirt design. The look of Snoopy. I mean, he's just, from his feet to his neck, it's solid rope.
It is unhilarious.
That's one of those Tard McFarlane sculpture editions.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And now, is this so? At this point, though, Charlie Brown is responsible for Snoopy.
Yes, that's true.
Oh, yeah.
He has been drifting around through the neighborhood throughout all of these strips. You could almost say this city ordinance is what now cements it that someone has to take care of him. But it's sort of Violet just assumes Charlie Brown is the one that would have to take care of Snoopy.
Right.
Yeah.
But this,
that might have been established earlier and we just didn't notice it.
No, I don't think so. And someone could correct me if I'm wrong.
Maybe our listeners can chime in if they see an earlier hint that Charlie Brown is the owner.
I've been trying to look at that really, really closely.
Well, just two prior, he's feeding Snoopy with the dog dish. Have we seen that before inside his house?
Oh, that's interesting. No, maybe not.
But that doesn't necessarily mean.
No, it doesn't.
He seems obligated.
No prize for whoever finds the first strip that confirms ownership of Snoopy.
Well, this is my pick. This is the one because it literally says, you know, have you tied up Snoopy since people have to tie up their dogs? So that's my pick, but I could be wrong.
Well, let's find out.
November 12th. Violet is berating Charlie Brown, who holds his head in his hands as he stares into a fishbowl. "You're always moaning about nobody liking you." Violet continues, "Well, good grief, Charlie Brown. Do you ever try to make somebody like you? Do you? Do you ever really try to be pleasant? Do you ever really try to be cheerful?" Charlie Brown says, "You don't like me, do you?"
So this has already happened earlier this year where Patty was berating Charlie Brown. But that was your only good old Charlie Brown. This is a continuation of that with Violet. And this gag resonates for me. I think it is a better gag than the one with Patty, because Patty is, you know, it just doesn't quite make sense. It seems like it's maybe in Charles Schulz's head, it makes sense. It's certainly idiosyncratic that someone's trashing a character for being good. However, we can date that all the way back to the very first strip ever in Peanuts. So I don't know what's going on in Schulz's head about people who are good in the minds of a group being hated and disliked and failures.
Yeah, but you say that. I find that interesting because they're not saying good Charlie Brown. They're saying good old Charlie Brown. And I don't think good in that instance means is a signifier of virtue. I think good old Charlie Brown is like, my good old sweatshirt. It just means something dependable and reliable to be around.
But do you hate your good old sweatshirt?
I might hate my good old sweatshirt, but Shermie's being a hypocrite in the first one.
Okay, you know? Put that down as another trait.
Yeah, but Shermie is the one saying it, right?
And I think,
yeah.
And I think, there you go. He's a hypocrite. Oh, man, boy. All right, see, he's getting more complex already, guys. I think, follow me on this journey. The Shermometer is going to be huge.
Shermy grows over time. He just becomes more stalwart. That's okay.
But I guess what I'm saying is, like, you wouldn't say good old Mick Jagger, right? That's just absurd, right? But if you say good old Larry,
yeah, but I wouldn't say I like Mick Jagger either.
That has nothing to do with liking him, though. You know, what I'm saying is what Patty is saying isn't that he's good and that's the problem. What she's saying is he's ordinary. All you are will ever be is the dependable townie. The dependable schmo around town that everybody says hi to. That's all you'll ever be. You'll never be a baseball player. You'll never be whatever else. That's how I read it. No?
Yeah, I always equate that with people who enjoy being with that person, you know, the good old boys who hang out together, you know.
Yeah.
I would assume they enjoy each other's company. But anyway, yeah, it's I haven't seen it elsewhere. It's unique to Schultz in terms of how he focuses on it, and it's interesting. It's surprising.
David Foster Wallace, who's one of my favorite writers, uses the good old thing a lot. For someone who's a literary writer, this is my good old big ballpoint pen, and I'm typing on my good old Corona Select or whatever. He's Midwestern too, so I wonder if good old also is used there regionally a lot more than it is in other places.
When you say Midwestern, is he like near Minneapolis, Minnesota, or Wisconsin, or is he like?
No, Illinois.
Well. I don't know. That's interesting. Maybe some people can also respond to that.
Actually, if some people could just do our podcast for us, that would be fabulous. That would be
lovely. I appreciate that.
No, then we would. Well, miss out on
it. I want people to do another job too, because then panel two, Violet says, "Good grief!" And we've totally ignored "Good grief."
Good grief.
But we have seen them.
Where does "Good grief" start?
Okay. All right, we have a couple assignments for ourselves and our listeners for next time. And if you have something to add to the thermometer, throw it in there. We know he's a hypocrite who cares about his appearance, but he's a good listener. Just describing your average cartoon character.
Yeah, that's pretty standard.
Here comes Shermie, the good listening hypocrite.
Good old listening hypocrite.
Off topic.
There is nothing off topic.
Okay, then what year did that song come out? Charlie Brown, He's a Clown. Why is it?
Oh, yeah, 1954, I think. And I believe it theoretically has nothing to do with each other, right?
But it says that, why is everybody always picking on me?
It's really weird. But he's also calling the teacher daddy-o.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's 1959.
Yeah, I thought it was later.
Well, that's pretty, yeah, that's interesting.
All right, we'll come back to it in 4 years.
Right, yeah, exactly. Completely coincidental.
They just don't want to get sued.
And what about Hang on, Snoopy? we talk about that. I really thought it was Hang on, Snoopy.
Yeah, I thought it was Hang on, Snoopy, too.
Well, according to one online source, which I'm sure is highly reliable. Oh, yeah. 1952. There is a first Good Grief.
Oh, there you go.
What?
Somebody says 52. So June 6, 1952, somebody says Good Grief. Doesn't say Charlie Brown says
it. Well, we are failures.
Yeah. I quit.
Well, we
good
feel like
grief. Brown. Rats.
I can't stand it.
November 22nd. Charlie Brown is walking behind Snoopy. Snoopy looks pleased with himself. Charlie Brown looks angry. Charlie Brown says, "Whoever heard of a dog doing imitations?" He continues, "It's silly, that's what it is. I don't know why I bother talking about it." Snoopy looks off panel. He sees something that attracts his attention. Now Charlie Brown sees Snoopy sitting next to Lucy. His ears are made into a perfect imitation of Lucy's appearance. Charlie Brown says, "Oh, stop it." Charlie Brown and Snoopy walk away as Lucy says, "Stop it? Stop what, Charlie Brown?" Charlie Brown says, "Never mind. What you don't know won't hurt you." But wait, there's more. November 23rd. Charlie Brown is talking to Snoopy. Snoopy has a pained look on his face. Charlie Brown says, "You just keep on imitating people. You'll get yourself in trouble, Snoopy." Charlie Brown walks away saying, "What a dog." Now we see Snoopy hopping behind Violet, perfectly imitating her. Violet senses something's going on behind her and turns to confront Snoopy, who turns away, embarrassed, dropping the imitation.
I think he's scared. You don't mess with Violet.
That's true. You don't want to mess with the Vi.
She's by herself, though, right?
Yeah,
she's not the evil Violet.
She's always the evil Violet.
You like how Snoopy's blush on his face goes into his teeth?
Oh, I never noticed that. That's weird. I always thought his mouth was closed. I never noticed the little teeth there. That's strange.
The gorgeous drawings.
Yeah, it's a great use of the cartoon form that he's able to turn this dog into these other characters. I never heard of anyone even attempting something like this, to do visual imitations in a comic strip. It's a brilliant idea. And it really shows how facile of a cartoonist
he is. It really is.
Yeah. And he carries this on a lot.
And that he's willing to break the rules.
During this next period, I always think of it as the Snoopy imitation years, because that's his shtick. It's mostly different animals, but it's also people.
And this evolves.
Yeah, I love how the little parentheses around Snoopy's eyes match Lucy's. He's really a good imitator.
That's true. Very cute. December 1st. Lucy is hanging out at Schroeder's piano as Schroeder practices. Lucy says, "The man I marry must be tall and handsome." She continues, "The man I marry must be strong and brave and true." Schroeder continues to play the piano. Lucy continues to talk. "The man I marry must know how to play the accordion." Schroeder yells, "Good!" sending Lucy flying.
I love this strip. I think it's great. It's just a funny drawing. And seeing Schroeder have these outbursts is particularly funny this year. I don't know why, when Charlie Brown's reading an article, or he's just quiet until he's not.
Yeah, it makes you really grateful that Schroeder found music, because if he didn't have that outlet, he's a pretty hot-headed kid.
Right.
I'd also just like to shout out to my mother, Anna Mae Gownley, because she could play the accordion, or she called it the cordine.
Really?
Yep.
Did she play it in the band or anything, or what was
No, she was not. My uncle was allowed to take accordion lessons. He was the only. I don't know why he was allowed and the others weren't. Maybe it was sexism because the others are all girls. But he took the accordion lessons and he taught my mom. And then he had a polka band, but he wouldn't let her in.
Oh,
that is.
But she could rock it. December 3rd. Lucy and Linus are standing out in the gently falling snow. Lucy says to Linus, "Try to catch the snowflakes on your tongue, Linus." He does. In the third panel, we see him chowing down on it. Smack, smack. He turns to Lucy. "Needs sugar." The reason I pointed this one out, guys, is because it's one of the gags that's used in A Charlie Brown Christmas. And I'm trying to use this podcast for many things, therapy mostly, but also try to just sort of crack the code of Peanuts on all the different levels. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is that it was 15 years before the first Peanuts animated stuff comes out. And he just cherry picks the best gags from the 15 years of the best comic strip ever and puts them in those early specials. And they just work. Sometimes they'll even change the characters, but not always. So I'm just trying to keep a little running tally of when we're going to see those gags that get repeated in Charlie Brown Christmas.
As a little kid, I remember that term "needs sugar" was a part of my life, and nothing was sweet enough to my taste. And seeing Linus say that just resonated with little 6-year old me. He's like, yeah, someone who's speaking the important stuff.
Sugar is the number one food group of childhood, especially back then when nobody thought anything about anything. Put 6 tablespoons.
Yeah, when sugar was not hidden from the names of the cereals, they were built into the title. Sugar.
Yeah, then it all suddenly changed to sugar golden. Bombs. It became golden Grahams and golden snacks.
Honey crisp. Yeah, it's not. They used to call stuff like high fructose smacks. No more.
Hey, tip, if you're out there, if you don't like the high fructose corn syrup, go into your international foods aisle. Get yourself some Mexican Coke. Use the real sugar. It's good stuff.
Mm.
This episode has been brought to you by Mexican Coke. Also, great band name, Charlie Brown, which is another segment I think we're starting. That's a great band name, Charlie Brown. December 16th. Charlie Brown and Schroeder are walking in a whiteout condition blizzard. In the foreground, Snoopy sits shivering. Charlie Brown says, "Snoopy looks kind of cold, doesn't he?" Schroeder says, "I'll say he does. Maybe we'd better go over and comfort him." They walk over to Snoopy and say, "Be of good cheer, Snoopy." "Yes, be of good cheer." Then they walk away, leaving Snoopy behind, a question mark over his head. Take that, Dostoevsky. This is my favorite Peanuts comic strip. I have thought about this a lot, and I've limited it down to about three or four that are my top tier Peanuts strips, but this is my number one. So I guess it's my favorite work of comic art of all time. It was reprinted in the very first Peanuts book I ever saw, which was this weird half self-help, half comic strip collection called What's It All About, Charlie Brown. And I remember it tied in around somehow around the same time. And this one was very little. I was like 3 years old. So they're all hazy memories. But I had learned that there was a person who drew cartoons. My dad had explained it to me because I had previously not sort of understood how these things manifested into our reality. They just were. I thought, oh, that's interesting. You can kind of do that. And I remember my mom reading me this strip and me not understanding it and her trying to explain it to me and it not being the greatest explanation. Or again, I was three and just not able to understand it. But this is what the genius of Charles Schulz is and what the genius of this comic strip is. So if you're a little boy and you have no context of the world at all and you read this comic strip, it's sort of funny because you relate to Snoopy. And these two kids who are older than Snoopy and more sophisticated than Snoopy come over and say something that he doesn't understand. And then they walk away. And you get that and you think that's funny because you don't understand it either. Then you get a little bit older and you think, you read it again and you think, oh, I sort of understand it now. Now I understand it much better. What's happening is there's a play on two different types of comfort. We think that Schroeder is suggesting they go over and give him physical comfort because he's cold, but they just go over and give him spiritual comfort. So it's this play on language, and that's what makes it funny. And then a few years go by and you read it again and you go, oh, be of good cheer. That's a legitimate biblical reference. I think it's in John where and Jesus says something like, Don't worry about this world because I've conquered it. Be of good cheer. I'm pretty sure that's not an exact quote, but that's the idea. So now it becomes this thing where they're like, it's being hypocritical. It's these kids who are going over and they think that they have something to offer Snoopy because they have this perceived wisdom that they've gained. And they go over and they say, be of good cheer, but they haven't followed the meaning of it because they've left Snoopy behind and they haven't comforted him in the way that he needed. And I'm sure if I read this again in 5 years, it'll mean something else. And to me, that's what makes this such an amazing work of art from beginning to end. It's that he can deal with all of these levels. It communicates to everybody despite your understanding of it. And it's never pretentious because he's never pretending. This is something he's thought about. He's involved in the Church of God. He's involved in the art instruction school. These are people who are thinkers who are having conversations about important things. But he's not taking anybody's way of thinking for granted. He's questioning it. He's probing it. He's being philosophical about it. And then somehow he manages to magically put it into this little comic strip about two boys and a dog. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. And my theory here is we've not seen Schulz put scripture into Peanuts up to this point. And I'm sure, even though, yeah, it was a big part of his life, he felt it was inappropriate to do so, or he wasn't comfortable doing so. I have a quote from a 1963 Collegiate Challenge article where he was kind of talking about this idea. As I work for the secular press through a newspaper syndicate, and naturally I must exercise care in the way I go about expressing things. I have a message that I want to present, but I would rather bend a little to put over a is it position, I think, than to have the whole strip dropped because of it, a point, put over a point. And so I think that's what he's doing here. He's taking two concepts. The other thing that he's obliquely referring to is James, I think it's 2:15 and 16. It says, suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? And then he doesn't use the language from that. He actually takes another biblical reference that would prick up the ears of people who were familiar with it to suggest that this is what he's doing without actually making a direct quote out of the Bible, which I think is pretty genius and actually makes for a richer strip in a way.
Well, and that's why he can do all of these things, because he is always doing it at a deeper and in some ways more sincere and more thoughtful level. I mean, I like BC as much as the next person, but BC would do some religious stuff and it just becomes this sort of self-congratulatory, where this is actually critical, gently, and making you think, but it's something that I think someone who took these things really seriously felt important enough to put in a comic strip and was brilliant enough to be able to put it in a way that it conveys to everybody.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it is weird. It is definitely Schroeder. It's hard to tell who the first kid is. It could be Shermie. It can't be Linus.
They're all bundled up.
Yeah, they're all bundled up because it's this existential whiteout blizzard. There's no background at all. It's just swirling wind and snow. But I did look up in the index before we recorded, and according to the Fantagraphics edition, that is in fact Schroeder. That's as good as it gets. If that doesn't make you realize that comic strips are as great an art form as there have ever existed, I don't know what will. December 28th. Charlie Brown and Schroeder are standing outside in the snow. Schroeder says, here comes Shermie. Ask him. Schroeder turns to Charlie Brown and says, go ahead, Charlie Brown. Ask him. Charlie Brown says, you ask him. Schroeder says, no, you ask him. Charlie Brown says to Shermie, whatever happened to Davy Crockett? And that's where we end the air.
The Shermometer just burst through the top.
The Shermometer. Shermie has some knowledge. He is mature. He knows stuff.
Well, what's the word for it?
He is
knowledgeable.
Knowledgeable.
And I love that
he's knowledgeable.
And there's this little delegation that's sent out. And they have to decide who will ask Shermie the question. So
what happened to Davy Crockett? And everybody knows he became Daniel Boone.
Right.
And this is a world where you still have some age differences, where Schroeder's a little bit shorter than Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown's a little bit shorter than Shermie. You're guessing that you could say that Schultz is looking at Shermie being the oldest, Charlie Brown being in the middle, and Schroeder being the youngest.
Shermie is definitely taller.
He's taller. Is that a personality trait?
Yes. Yeah. Tallness is definitely.
Yeah. According to good like trait. The Marvel Comics rule, that would
taller,
be
a old
personality trait.
Yeah. So he's kind of a guru to these kids. Yeah. Like, oh, wise one.
Yeah. He's not really in their world. He's a little bit separate from them. Occasionally he will enter in, but it's almost like he's deigning to enter into their world.
Maybe they'll form a cult and worship him.
Stay tuned for 1956. All right. So guys, give me your summation of 1955. Why don't you start, Harold?
Well, this year is a solidifying of the characters and their personalities. We're seeing them being stretched a little bit. Snoopy is really coming into his own, and it's exciting to see these strong declaratory characters finding a voice through Schultz's pen. It's pretty cool. I really do like this year. We are also seeing that loosening of style a little bit, where he's becoming comfortable with his tools and he's not trying to make everything absolutely pristine. There's a little bit of looseness coming in. And so it's feeling more and more like the Peanuts that ran, you know, through the 70s and into the even the 80s, that feel is starting to get there, and it's consistently excellent. It's pretty awe-inspiring, the quality of what he's doing and the breadth of this, the jokes and the feeling you have toward these characters is quickly deepening.
Yeah. It deepening is a good word. The whole strip is deepening. The looseness that's coming in is giving it an expressive quality, but he still manages to keep the design absolutely beautiful. It's a fantastic, fantastic year. Michael, how about you? What are your final thoughts on the year?
Oh, it's so solid. I mean, everything. The Sundays have been brilliant for a couple of years, but I think the dailies are now up to the super high level, consistently great. Yeah, I don't know if is this maybe this is the best year. We'll find out.
Well, I was going to ask this question. If it ended right here, if he just retired as champion and went off to, you know, play bridge professionally or whatever else he would do, where do you think we'd rank Peanuts these days?
No one ever topped this.
Right? That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is the year he wins that Rubin Award. And obviously his peers thought he was doing something exceptional. But at the same time, I think it would be remembered in little niches and corners of pop culture.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking specifically, I guess, about in the world of comics. But do you think there would be out there as still a pop culture thing at all? Like in the general wider?
Yeah, it would be like a cult following who remembers these.
Yeah, in the comics world, I think it would be appreciated, but it would not be anything like what it is now.
But fortunately, he didn't quit.
Yes.
And neither are we. We're not going to quit either. We're going all the way to the year 2000. Hey, and if you want to follow along with our conversations, why don't you check us out on the social medias that all the kids are talking about these days? You can follow us on the Twitter. And you can follow us on the Instagram. We're Unpack Peanuts. You could check out our website, unpackingpeanuts.com, where you can listen to episodes and vote on your favorite strip of the year. Speaking of, let's wrap it up with the strip of the year. I always go last, but I am not going last this time because I don't want to lose my favorite pick. I am going with 1216, Be of Good Cheer, Snoopy. I just think for all those reasons I said earlier, it's as good as a comic strip can be.
Yeah, it's excellent. No argument. My pick of the year is back in July 31st, that amazing baseball Sunday when Snoopy catches the ball and is thrown to home plate. It's so beautifully done. July 31st, if you are listening to this podcast and you get a chance to see a strip, I would absolutely recommend you seek this one out online and enjoy what Schultz was able to do in 1955. It just has the whole package, the characters, the characterizations, the humor, the beautiful visuals. I just love that strip.
Yeah, really, if you do go to look these things up like you can on Go Comics, just take a moment and really enjoy the drawing in that strip, across all of them, but in that strip in particular. Beautiful, beautiful cartooning. Michael, what's your pick?
I will go with May 22nd, another baseball strip. This is Charlie Brown racing, jumping over barbed wire, running down alleys, following the ball, getting ready to catch it, and it pops out of his glove. It's not profound.
Well, in a way it is, right?
But it would only work as a... Well, I mean, the effort, you got to give him some credit for the effort, Charlie Brown. And even though he failed, it was a great run.
And great drawing again.
Oh, yeah. And this would only work as a Sunday, of course. No way you could boil this down to four panels.
No. Again, taking total advantage of that Sunday strip. Love the drawing in this one. These are good picks. Guys, if you're out there, you can go to our website and you can vote for what you think is your favorite, too. I'm right, but, you know, you're allowed to have a different opinion, I guess. Anyway. So that's the show. We'll be back next week with 1956 or possibly a special episode. I don't know. But we'll be back either way next week. Until then, I'm Jimmy from Michael and Harold. Thanks for listening and be good. And be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpacked Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
Good grief!